Thank you. So I hope you did your homework. So let me briefly recall as to what we did yesterday. So we started with a GCM A and associated to this a Lie algebra, which is in general infinite dimensional and which generalizes the semi-simple Lie algebras, finite dimensional semi-simple Lie algebras. So this is so-called Kac-Moody Lie algebra. And then we defined its Weyl group. Well, before that we did the root space decomposition. So this I need that, so let me recall again. So G alpha, alpha in delta, actually I'm going to decompose into two parts. So these correspond to the positive roots, these correspond to negative roots, and then we defined the parabolic subgroup PY, its Levi component GY, its nil radical UI, and right. And if we take Y to be empty set, then PY, so PY is nothing but the Borel subalgebra, and these are all standard parabolic, standard Levi, standard, well, once PY is fixed, UI is fixed. So, okay. And then we define the Weyl group. And then we defined the Verma module M lambda, for any lambda in the dual of the Cartan. And then we defined category O. I mean, very roughly, category O consists of those modules whose weight space edge are only grow in one direction. They are not allowed to grow in the other direction. So the weights should lie in a finite union of cones like this. And so M lambda is one important member of category O. And finally, we defined this for lambda in dominant weights, I mean in the set of dominant integral weights. So D was defined to be those mu in H star such that mu of alpha I check is in Z plus. So that's the set of dominant integral weights. And if we take one of, I mean, if we take a dominant integral weight, then yesterday, we defined this L max lambda, and this was quotient of the Verma module divided by Fi lambda alpha I check plus 1 acting on 1. So this was the highest weight vector of M lambda, and then you take the UG submodule generated by these things where I runs between 1 and L. And that's where I required lambda alpha I check to be non-negative integer, because otherwise it does not make sense. Okay, so and also we define the notion of an integrable module. And let me remind that to you. So the definition was that it should be a weight module So V, so V should be a weight module. That means that it should be direct sum of its weight is passage. So that's requirement number one. And requirement number two is that all these EIs and FIs should act locally nilpotently. So those were the requirement for a representation to be an integrable module. Now, so, right. So I guess we left off at this exercise last evening that L max lambda is indeed an integrable module. So now I'm going to prove something stronger than this exercise. I mean, not prove, but state. So theorem that any, and also we define the notion of highest weight module. So let me put it here. So by highest weight module, we mean of highest weight lambda, we mean any quotient of the Verma module, M lambda. So the theorem which I want to state here is that any integrable highest weight G module, let's say V, with highest weight lambda is a quotient of L max lambda for lambda in particular lambda is in D, because that's the only case where L max lambda has been defined. So when I say L max lambda, I am supposing that lambda is in D, otherwise it's not even defined. So this theorem asserts that any integrable highest weight G module with highest weight lambda is a quotient of L max lambda. So in particular, and this is the same lambda again, so in particular lambda in G. Conversely, any quotient of L max lambda is integrable. In fact, this is a triviality, this converse part, if you complete this exercise, since I could just say that any sub module of an integrable module is integrable, and so is any quotient. So the integrable modules, that property remains intact under sub and quotients, and under finite sums, and under also finite direct sum of integrable modules is integrable. Now here, I should give you a word of warning that quotient of a highest weight module is indeed highest weight module by definition, because a highest weight module by definition is quotient of M lambda, and you take further quotient, so it's still quotient of M lambda. So quotient of a highest weight module, integrable highest weight module is integrable highest weight, but that's not true for sum, and in fact it's false. And of course, I mean, if you take direct sum of highest weight module is not highest weight, more or less never. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, so I was saying that this part is a trivial consequence of this exercise and this small remark. And this remark actually is very easy to prove from just the definitions. Okay, so that more or less concludes the discussion of the Lie algebra part. So now I need to bring in the groups, their flag varieties, and then the de Maizière character formula. So this lecture I plan to devote to somewhat careful construction of the group, which is quite a non-trivial job to do. So I hope to complete the construction of the group and also start the construction of the flag variety in this lecture. And then the afternoon lecture, I would start with the de Maizière character formula. So let's see. Yes. So now I want to, so construction of the, let me see what is the most efficient way. So there are three boards I could keep. Now trouble is that if I, so I should start with the second boards. Right, so I guess. So let's see, so construction of Kass-Moody groups. Now, there are a couple of different ways to do this construction. I am only going to give you one of the constructions. So to do that construction, let me tell you what the strategy is going to be, and then we will gradually implement that strategy. So let's see how the finite dimensional algebraic group associated to, let's say, a semi-simple Lie algebra is constructed, or one of the ways it's constructed. So one of the ways it is constructed is first you define. So let's see. So we have a finite dimensional semi-simple Lie algebra G. So we take a Borel subalgebra here, and we write it as direct sum of Cartan and the nil radical of the Borel. So it's quite easy to construct a group associated to a nilpotent Lie algebra. And in fact, I'm going to state a precise theorem which says that the class of nilpotent Lie algebras, I mean finite dimensional nilpotent Lie algebras, and unipotent algebraic groups, that class is completely, I mean, isomorphic. I mean, the bijective. So the category of finite dimensional nilpotent Lie algebras and category of finite dimensional unipotent algebraic groups, together with morphisms, is a complete equivalence of categories, and that's a fairly simple fact and a very classical fact. So what one does is that one associates the unipotent group under this categorical equivalence. So from N, you get the unipotent group. Now the Cartan is an abelian Lie algebra, and it's not difficult to construct a torus such that, and I will say this, in fact, I'm going to do it very precisely. So we do need, yeah, so from this, it's fairly easy to construct T, and this is a semi-direct product. So that means that T acts on U. So we can take the semi-direct product of these two groups, and then we would have recovered the Borel subgroup. Now, the next job to do is to construct the So the Weyl group already is there from the Lie algebra. So as I defined yesterday, to define the Weyl group, I did not need any group whatsoever. So the Lie algebra was sufficient to define the Weyl group. So now, but what we want to do is that we want to, so we do have at our disposal the wild group, but we want to define normalizer of torus. Of course, you talk of normalizer only when this group is embedded in some other group, and we do not have a large group to be where we have embedded. So one is going to somewhat artificially define this normalizer of torus so that we have an exact sequence like this. So what I'm going to do, I am going to define an exact sequence like this with this T here and with the wild group here. So that means that now we have constructed B and we have constructed N. And now there is an old result of Tate's which says that the group G is obtained as an amalgamated product of B and N. And I mean, to be absolutely imprecise, and so if you use the Bruha decomposition, then G can be written as B W B. And I'm going to be extremely imprecise here. So G is written as B W B, where B is this B and W is wild group elements. So this runs over W in wild group elements. So in any case, what is indeed true that G is generated by B and W. And this amalgamated product exactly says how it is generated. You see, when one says that something is generated by some subgroups, so you already, it presupposes that you already have the ambient group, which we do not. So I'm going to define this notion of amalgamated product, and then that's how this G is going to be constructed. So that's the very rough strategy of what I'm going to use. So now I would start to construct this U, this T, and this N. So these are three most important ingredients, and then I will talk about the amalgamated product. So you see, already we run into some problem here because this categorical equivalence, so let me state this as a theorem in any case. So the category of finite dimensional nilpotently algebras is in bijective correspondence with the category of finite dimensional unipotent algebraic groups. So, and in fact, this equivalence goes rather simply by taking a unipotent group here and just taking its Lie algebra. And this category means that we allow arbitrary Lie algebra homomorphisms here. So the morphisms are arbitrary Lie algebra homomorphisms, and morphisms here are arbitrary algebraic group morphisms. So this is an equivalence of category. But already we run into a problem because we have finite dimensional here, otherwise it's no more true. So, but this N, even though I never mentioned that earlier, but probably you have guessed that actually this example of affine Kasmuri already shows that it's infinite dimensional. And in fact, finite dimensional is the case when it's semi-simple Lie algebra, that's it. So once it is not semi-simple Lie algebra, then it becomes infinite dimensional. Okay. So now we already run into this problem that we cannot apply this theorem directly. So that's what I'm going to do now. So we need a little bit of a formalism if I want to do a precise job, which I want to, that I will define what is called, pro-Lie algebra. So pro-Lie algebra, let me first define it imprecisely and then I will define it precisely. So pro-Lie algebra is nothing but which is built as inverse limit of inverse system of finite dimensional Lie algebras. So a pro-Lie algebra is inverse limit of finite dimensional Lie algebras. And once you take inverse limit, it comes equipped with some kind of a topology, even though it's kind of a very, very weak topology, but it does become quite helpful in keeping track of various things. So now let me define it precisely. So let S be a Lie algebra. And this underline is just supposed to be that it's supposed to be a German character, which I cannot draw. So let S be a Lie algebra, and let F be a non-empty family of ideals. Ideals I in S of finite codimension. So finite codimension just means that F mod I is of finite dimension. That's what I mean by I is finite codimension. So let's take a Lie algebra together with a family of ideals which are all of finite codimension. Then this pair is a pro Lie algebra if some properties hold, which let me list. So a pro Lie algebra is not only a Lie algebra. It's more than a Lie algebra. So it's additional structure. So a pro Lie algebra is a Lie algebra together with a family of ideals, pre-specified family of ideals. And this family should satisfy certain properties. And this property is being that if I1, I2 is in the family, then I1 intersection I2 should be in the family. Two, if I1 is in the family and I is a certain ideal which contains I1, then this implies, so I is an ideal. Then what happens? Then I is in the family. Three is that, let's consider this Lie algebra G, this S, and we have a map to S mod I for any I in the family. Let me first write and then I will explain. Okay, so first of all, So I have to back up a little bit. So this F is a directed set. So F is a directed set. Under the partial order, given by. So I1 is less than equal to I2 if I1 contains I2. So it's reverse. So I1 is less than equal to I2 if I1 contains I2. So smaller and smaller ideals become larger and larger in this partially ordered set. That's the way to remember it. So now this is, now let's consider, right. Oops. So now let's consider the map S to S mod I, the quotient map. And so this is a directed set, so S mod I is an inverse system now. Because of this relation, S mod I is an inverse system. So now I'm going to take inverse limit where I is running in F. Right? So this F is a directed system. So this makes a inverse system S mod I, and now I'm going to take inverse limit of I in F, and then there is a canonical map from S to inverse limit of this one, and this map is required to be an isomorphism. So requirement is, so phi from this, phi is required to be isomorphism. So that's the definition of a pro-Lie algebra. I hope I'm not leaving out any condition. No, I think that is correct. Okay. So exactly parallelly, there is notion of pro-algebraic groups. Pro-algebraic groups. And let me quickly define this. So, okay. So let G be a group, and when I say a group, be an abstract group. Why not I use the letter S here, because I used the S there. Be an abstract group. Abstract group means just a group, no other structure. And let F be a non-empty family. Non-empty family of normal subgroups. Actually, this notion is very parallel to this, normal subgroups of S, such that, actually, I should not stop here, such that for every N in F, now F mod N. So S is a group and N is a normal subgroup. So S mod N is a group. So such that for every N in F, F mod N is given an algebraic group structure. So we did not have any structure on S and N, but S mod N now is a group which is required to have an algebraic group structure. So I could start with any field K and I could take algebraic groups over K. But in any case, I'm working with complex numbers. So you can just take to be complex. Well, yes, so algebraic group structure, if you can give, then it has to be found on S. Right. So if it's given an algebraic group structure, then this S and this family F is called a pro group. If the following conditions are satisfied, okay. So, so in fact, some of them are very common. So, N1, N2 in F implies N1 intersection N2 is in F. 2. Now, for 2, you have to be a little bit careful. So let me write it, and then I will explain to you why one needs to be careful. So if N1 is in F, and N is a normal subgroup of F containing N1, such that N contains N1, then I mean, 2 just said that N belongs to the family F, but you should not expect that, because I mean, an algebraic group has lots of abstract subgroups which have absolutely no chance of being algebraic. So then we have to impose that restriction. So then N belongs to the family if and only if N mod N1 sitting inside G mod N1 is a closed subgroup. Now, a closed subgroup of an algebraic group is algebraic, and in fact, an algebraic subgroup is always closed. So that's this. And then third goes as it is. Actually, there is one other requirement here, that for N1 and 2 in the family F, such that N1 is contained in N2, the quotient map G mod N1 to G mod N2. You see, again, This did not manifest in the Lie algebra situation because it was automatically true. So the quotient map, so this is the standard quotient map. Now, this was automatically a Lie algebra homomorphism in the Lie algebra case. Oops, thanks. So, S, thanks. So, in the Lie algebra case, this map was automatically a Lie algebra homomorphism, and there was nothing more we required. But in this case, of course, it's a group homomorphism. S mod n1 to S mod n2 is, of course, a group homomorphism. But we did not have any connection between these algebraic groups, S mod n1 and S mod n2, to start with. Nothing we required. So now we require that this quotient map should be an algebraic group homomorphism. And finally, then we have the analog of 3. So 4 is that this map phi from S to inverse limit S mod n, and in F is an isomorphism of groups now, just abstract groups. See, S does not have any other structure. All the S mod n's have algebraic group structure, but S does not have one. So again, I mean, if I were to say imprecisely what a pro-algebraic group is, then it's inverse limit of algebraic groups. So that's how you should view this. Okay. So now, finally, I could define what is a analog. See, I am after generalizing this theorem. So I am after generalizing this theorem appropriately so that I could construct the corresponding unipotent group U from the Kac-Moody Lie algebra. And of course, there is already the positive part, so we want to do that. So that's what I am after. So let's come to that. Now, final definition before I... So definition, so a pro-Lie algebra S is called pro-nilpotent if each of S mod I is nilpotent for any I in the family F. So a pro-Lie algebra is called pro-nilpotent if all these S mod I's, they are honest good nilpotent. They are finite dimensional Lie algebra, so they should be honest good nilpotent Lie algebra. And similarly, exactly parallelly, a pro-algebraic, and in fact, I'm going to drop algebraic, so I'm just going to call it pro-group. S is called pro-unipotent if each of S mod n are unipotent algebraic groups. So they are honest algebraic groups, so I could honestly talk about their being unipotent. So that's what the definition of pro-unipotent. And now I think you can guess what I'm going to write. So theorem, so the category of, right, so that brings me, So let me state this theorem. And this theorem is still not completely precise, so I will make it precise after I stated the theorem. So theorem, the category of pro nilpotent pro Lie algebras age isomorphic with the category of pro unipotent pro groups. Okay, so now I have done a little bit of cheating so far. That, see, earlier I said that the category consisted of, so in this theorem, yeah, so in this theorem the category consisted of all the finite dimensional nilpotent Lie algebras and any Lie algebra homomorphisms between them. And similarly on this side it consisted of all the finite dimensional unipotent algebraic groups and any algebraic group homomorphisms between them. But now we are dealing with pro objects, pro Lie algebras and pro groups, and I already alluded to that besides some topology. But in any case, when we are considering homomorphisms between two pro Lie algebras, we should take some account of this topology, or we should take some account of this filtration. So this category of pro nilpotent pro Lie algebras, and I'm going to add the word and the continuous homomorphisms and the continuous Lie algebra homomorphisms and the, actually these are called, actually there is a more standard word here, and the pro Lie algebra homomorphisms and the pro algebraic group morphisms between them. So now the category does not consist of all possible Lie algebra homomorphisms, but only pro Lie algebra homomorphisms and pro algebraic group morphisms. And let me very quickly define this. Actually, it's very easy to define, so I can do that. So a Lie algebra homomorphism between two pro Lie algebras. So keep in mind that a pro Lie algebra is really a pair consisting of a Lie algebra and a family of preferred ideals. So a Lie algebra homomorphism between two pre-Lie algebras, so this Lie algebra homomorphism is just a usual Lie algebra homomorphism, is called a pro Lie algebra homomorphism if it is continuous under the pro topology. And since I have not defined pro topology, I am going to say okay that heights, okay, so I'm going to write this phi from S1 to S2 is called a pro Lie algebra homomorphism if for all I2 in S2, no, so I2 in the family 2. So let's take any ideal in the second family, that's the family corresponding to S2, phi inverse I2 is in family 1. So it's as simple as that. And exactly the same definition for a pro algebraic group morphism. So a similar definition for algebraic, pro algebraic group morphism. So if you take a normal subgroup in F2, then phi inverse of that normal subgroup should be in the family F1. Okay, so now I have made this theorem precise. Okay, so now the question is, okay, so at least we have been able to generalize this classical theorem between about correspondence between nilpotently algebras and unipotent groups. So if we are given a nilpotently algebra, then we can get a unipotent group. But now the question is that this theorem now requires a Prolyi algebra, pro-nilpotent Prolyi algebra, and then only we can start to do our work. And of course, we should, I mean, at least from the experience of finite dimensional theory, we have this G is H direct sum. I'm just going to write N plus, and I am going to write N minus, where N plus is nothing but weight space, root space H corresponding to the positive roots. And similarly, N minus H, weight space H, root space H corresponding to negative roots. So now the question is that are we lucky enough that this N plus is a Prolyi algebra? And actually, if you start to unwind the definition of Prolyi algebra and you just get some expertise in it, you will immediately realize that it could not be. Okay, and I'm not going to explain. It does require a little bit of knowledge of the Pro theory that, see, a Prolyi algebra has to be complete in some sense. That's the rough idea. And these things cannot be complete. So now I am going to complete it. And actually, I might drop this plus. When I don't say plus, that means it is plus. And when I have to say minus, then I will indeed put a minus. So I'm going to complete it. And there is one most stupid way to complete this. And that's, I am going to use the most stupid way. And that is, so N plus is direct sum, and I'm just going to take direct product. You see, so instead of taking direct sum, let's start with the most stupid way. So that's what we do. I mean, normally when we do, when we work on something, we start with the most stupid thing. If it doesn't work, we try to be a little bit more clever, a little bit more clever, and so on. So N plus hat, let's start with the most stupid way to handle this, and I'm going to take the direct product. Now, one thing immediately haunts us, that whether it is indeed a Lie algebra or not. See, for a Prolyi algebra, it has to be a Lie algebra to start with. Okay, so that's the first requirement, that it should be Lie algebra. Now, actually, one is lucky here that it's indeed a Lie algebra. So if I take a direct sum, infinite direct sum of elements x alpha, and infinite direct sum of elements cell y beta, beta and delta plus, and I guess this notation is self-explanatory, that x alpha belongs to g alpha and y beta belongs to g beta. And if we take the bracket, then I'm just going to define it x alpha y beta and alpha beta now in delta plus. And actually, you will immediately see that even though this is an infinite sum, but at any finite stage, only finitely many terms are going to contribute. So that's good news. So N plus hat is indeed a Lie algebra. Now, we want to make it into a Prolyi algebra. That means I have to give you a family of ideals. Okay. So that also is fairly easy to do. So let's define height of a root alpha. So let's write any root alpha, I can write it as sigma ni alpha I, where ni are some integers. So now the principal gradation of alpha is nothing but you take sigma ni and you take its absolute value. I mean, I'm dealing with positive roots right now, so I can forget about that. But at some point, you also do want to do this with n minus. So let's do this. And now I have to give you a family of ideals. So I'm going to first define a family of basic ideals. So this consists of those g alphas such that this height of alpha is at least k. Now this gives a family, and it's very easy to see that this is an ideal. So it's a family of ideals, and now it satisfies more or less all the properties. Only thing is that now I have to define you the family, so let me define this family. So family consists of all those ideals in, so ideals, I in N hat, such that I contains IK for some K. So this is going to be my family. And it's, so this will be exercise number 3, I guess, that F indeed, so now this N hat F is indeed a pro the algebra. Okay, so we have achieved this, and once we have done, once we have achieved this, then this theorem which I stated immediately constructs for us a pro-unipotent pro-group. So this is what this is. So I have constructed U. So, sorry. Yes, right, but as I said, I am going to drop my plus, so okay. Right. Yes.
So would it have one parameter subgroup that corresponds to the imaginary
group? Also, that's right, exactly. So that's the idea. You see, it's exactly, see, that's the point, that you cannot define one parameter group corresponding to imaginary roots unless you go to completion. And that's the idea. Exactly, absolutely. Okay, so I've defined U. Now let's come to torus. And then I come to N. And then I guess I will have to stop, unfortunately. So let's see. So where are we? So we start with the second board. So now let me define T now. So definition of T. And again, let's analyze the finite dimensional situation. So how does one define T? So in any case, I'm going to do the reverse process. And we want to define T in terms of the Lie algebra H. So whatever way we define T, its Lie algebra should be the Cartan. I mean, that's the first thing we have to achieve. That whatever way we choose to define T, its Lie algebra has to be Cartan H. Okay. So let's take this T which we want to define. We still don't have T, but let's assume that we have defined T, and let's try to see what are the properties we want for T. And then we have the exponential map. Now T, and this is actually, it turns out, because it's a Abelian Lie algebra, this is actually a group homomorphism. So we will be able to define T once we know what its kernel is. And its kernel in the finite dimensional theory, we know, is nothing but the weight lattice, or co-weight lattice, co-root lattice, sorry. So the kernel here is nothing but the co-root lattice. So that's the kernel. And once we have defined the kernel, then of course I can just say T to be H divided by HV. And I'm going to write this in slightly different form. But in any case, we need to know what the co-root lattice is. And we more or less know that in the Kasmoody theory as well, because in the finite dimensional case, co-root lattice is nothing but Z alpha I check. I from 1 to L. But there is one small point in the Kasmoody case which we need to be a little bit concerned about, and that is, this is not a lattice in H. This is not a lattice in H in general, I mean, unless co-rank of A is 0. So this is not a lattice of A. So we need to define a lattice. So definition. So we want to choose an integral form. So we choose an integral form H Z in H that is a finitely generated lattice HZ such that HZ, if I extend the scalars, I get this isomorphism satisfying the following. So we don't want to choose this lattice in an arbitrary manner, because in the finite dimensional case, we chose it as the sum of all the coroute vectors. So we cannot quite do that in the infinite case, but we should keep that as much as possible. So we want to, so we choose an integral form HZ in A, that is, integral form just means that a finitely generated lattice such that this is isomorphism, satisfying the following conditions. And one condition is that first of all, right, so first of all, alpha I check, Z alpha I check should be inside HZ. So that's condition one. And also, if we take, so alpha I should belong to Hom HZ, Z, Z. You see, this is sitting inside H star canonically. So this is space is sitting canonically inside H star, and those roots alpha I are here. So I demand that alpha I should be here. And finally, we want that, So we want that HZ divided by this thing is torsion free. Right. That's what we need. So this is torsion free. Okay, so once we have that, and we can always choose such a thing. It's not unique. I do want to warn you that it's not unique, but let's choose one. I mean, any other choice will not really make much of a difference in the theory. It will be very parallel theory. So let's choose once and for all, at least till tomorrow evening. So let's choose that, and then I define T, and then I will define N. And then I will stop. Okay, so let's see. So now T. So definition. So T is going to be defined Hom HZ star with C star Z. Okay, where H Z star is by definition Hom Z HZ Z. So I'm taking the dual of this, the integral dual of this, that's HZ star, and then I am defining T to be, so that's one other way to express without bringing in the exponential map. You see, the point is that I just want to avoid bringing in the exponential map. So that's the definition. And in fact, you can avoid the exponential map. So in the finite dimensional case, you can very easily convince yourself that this is what the torus is like. So this is the definition now. And finally, so I have defined now, let's see, we have defined U and we have defined T. And now I want to define the normalizer of torus. And that's the last thing I want to do. And then actually, we also want this T to act on U so that we can take the semi-direct product. But I think I will have to postpone that to the next lecture. So, but let me define N, so definition. And to define this N, we resort to an old theorem of Kitts, which gives the presentation for the normalizer of torus in the finite dimensional case. So definition, so let N be the group defined by generators and relations, defined by generators N, and I am going to take SI twiddle. SI we have the simple reflections, and these twiddles are supposed to be their lift in the normalizer. So where I runs between 1 and L. So these are just symbols. I'm defining N, I could not put N there. So T we have already defined. So let N be the group defined by generators. So generators means so every element of T. So I can just say T in T. And SI, subject to the following relations. So relation number one, relations of T. Okay, so T, I need to put, so I do want to get to T. So I have to impose, so I'm just taking elements of T and I'm taking free group generated by those things. So I have to impose relations of T, and then I need to impose some other relations. And let's see if I have it here. Ah, that's right. And then I need SI twiddle, T SI twiddle inversed should be SIT. And I will explain this in a minute. And 3, SI twiddle square equals minus 1 to the alpha I check. Actually, unfortunately, I have not defined this. Okay, so I will define that. And SI twiddle, SJ twiddle, SI twiddle, and so on is same as SJ twiddle, SI twiddle, SJ twiddle. And both sides have MIJ factors where MIJ is the order of SI times SJ. So this was happening in the while group. So SI, SJ, the product is an element in the while group. So this will have some order. Let's say, call it MIJ. So MIJ, if MIJ is less than infinity. Now, there is no guarantee that MIJ will be less than infinity. In fact, it's often not true. So whenever MIJ is less than infinity, then we have this relation. So both sides have MIJ factor. One starts with I, and another starts with J. So now, yes, actually, can I take, okay, so let's. So now I need to define SIT, and I need to define minus 1 to the alpha I check, and I guess everything else I've defined in this. So SIT, so the claim is that while group W acts on T. And actually that's very easy to see. So let's see how was T defined. So T was defined like this. Now T, let it not act on C star part. What am I talking about? While group. So we want the action of while group on T. So let while group does not act here. And while group acts on its Z star. And that's easy to see because the requirement 1 and requirement 2. That will force us that W acts. So actually, maybe I should have added that. So this choice, W acts on HZ and also on HZ star. X means there was already an action on H. What I'm saying that W keeps HZ stable. So W, sorry, maybe it's a better sentence. HZ stable and also HZ star stable. And that follows easily from condition 1 and 2. And if you like size, so this is what it is. Okay. So that is what this action is. So WX on T, and this was happening for T in T. So this makes good sense. Now finally, what is minus 1 to the power alpha I check? So minus 1 to the power alpha I check, this is an element in the torus. And so minus 1 alpha I check is an element in T. That means it's a, I have to define this as a homomorphism from Hz star to C star. That's what this is. So that means that if I give you a weight, you should give me a non-zero complex number. And this is nothing but minus 1 to the power lambda alpha I check. You see? So if you give me lambda, then I will give you a complex number. This is minus 1 to the power lambda alpha I check. So this is same alpha I check here. So I could have defined this for any Hz. So any element Hz, I would have defined. So for any H in Hz, so then I will just, yeah. So now I'm taking this one. Oops, sorry. H. So lambda is in Hz star, H is in Hz. So this is an integer. And once this is an integer, minus 1 to power integer makes sense. I mean, if I put a complex number, you might be in trouble. You might have to choose an appropriate branch. But there is no problem here. So that's this math. So I think I have defined everything. So that's the while group. And before I stop, so I said that we should have a exact sequence like this. Right? And in fact, there is. So first of all, n had t inside it. It's not clear that after you go through all these relations, T still embeds. That's not clear. But theorem is that there exists an exact sequence. Not that there exists an exact sequence. In fact, one could be more explicit. So this T goes to T. And now N is generated from T and SI twiddle. So T should go to 1 here, and SI twiddle should just go to SI. So I am being more specific than there exists. This map makes this an exact sequence. So I will stop here. So we have defined N, we have defined U, we have defined T. And now I have to define the amalgamated product and put it together. So I will do that this afternoon. And then I will define the flag variety. And hopefully I will start with the Demijohn vector formula today itself.